This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It's back to school in Charlotte-Mecklenburg. Every new school year brings changes, but that is particularly true this year, what with severe budget cuts. So on this first day of school, we've invited Guy Chamberlain to join us for the first part of our program. Mr. Chamberlain is Associate Superintendent for Auxiliary Services at CMS. Welcome back. I am astounded that you can spend a nanosecond with us this morning.
I always have a few minutes for you, Mike.
But the first day of school and the first day of school with a whole new system of busing for magnet students, I mean, how are you working us in? Why aren't you out there?
Well, I'm about halfway through my day. I started several hours ago.
I'll bet you did. How's it going so far? Do you know?
Very smooth. The big issue on our plate right now is the shuttle stops.
Right.
We have staff at each one of those. They're operating very smoothly. The turnout is lower than those that have signed up, but typically on the first day of school, you don't get every student showing up. But we're at about 40% of what we expect in the next couple weeks.
Just so people know, you oversee a lot of different things at CMS, school construction issues, transportation needs, budgetary issues. You deal with the nutrition programs in the schools, among other things. And in your time at CMS, I'm told you've overseen 36 new schools, 18 replacement schools, and a couple of other statistics. And it's been a boom time over the last several years for CMS, with most of the worries being, how are we going to manage this incredible growth? Where are we going to find the money to build the schools needed to house these students? And that's pretty much stopped. The whole paradigm has shifted now, and it's, where do we find the money to fund what we already have? Given the budgetary restrictions that you're facing this year, what's the biggest or most dramatic thing that teachers, parents, students will face this year?
Well, from my perspective, from a facility standpoint, we still have a large number of our facilities that still need a lot of work. A few years ago, about half of our inventory dated back to the 60s, the 50s, and prior to that. Mm-hmm. Now, with the new schools, we have refreshed our inventory, but we still have a substantial amount of work to existing schools to bring them up to reasonable standards.
And does the money exist to do that now?
The money exists. The voters approved a $527 million bond referendum in 2007.
But we're not issuing those bonds.
There's still about $320 million left to be issued. Don't know when that might happen. We're struggling. Mm-hmm. One of the challenges that I have is that in 1985, we had 8.5 million square feet. We had about 240 maintenance trades to take care of that. Today we've got 20 million square feet and we've got 208 maintenance trades to take care of that. So our staffing has been reduced. We've more than doubled the inventory of square footage. Mm-hmm. I think we're doing things smarter than we did in 1985, but it's still a struggle.
Those schools that you say are not quite up to standard, what are they missing? What's wrong with them? What condition are they in?
Generally, well, they're clean. I think our focus is to make sure that the schools are clean. There are air conditioning and heating issues in a lot of schools. Our focus has got to be on healthy learning environments, indoor environmental quality, which is the air they breathe, good lighted facilities, well-lighted facilities, and facilities that are good from a sound standpoint, and some of our classrooms are loud.
Really? Because there's not acoustic tile, or because they're
too
big?
We have acoustic tile. The way they were built, the reverberation rate, hard surfaces. So we're doing things to attenuate that, but the limited resources that we have to make that happen, it's going to be a slow road to get to every single classroom in the district.
It's my recollection from eighth grade that problem is solved by spitballs on the ceiling. I'm just kidding. one of the big issues, as we've said, has been overcrowding over the years, and we've had a lot of people complain that their child is studying in a mobile classroom. This year, I'm told, you are retiring or eliminating or putting in storage, mothballs, 700 mobile classrooms. Is that right?
Not quite, but about half of the inventory of 1,200 will be placed in mothballs.
Now, why is that? Well, how are you able to do that?
A couple things have happened. In the last 10 years, we've been able to build 1,700 new classrooms. We have also acquired additional mobile classrooms. Growth has tempered. We've added 32,000 students in the last decade, most of which were in the first 6 years of that decade. The last few years, growth has been pretty flat. This year, we're going to add 1,700 students or thereabouts. We've had years where we had almost 5,000 students. So we've managed to catch up. We are in the position now to at least put some of these mobile classrooms in mothballs. My guess is, though, in the next 7 or 8 years, we will refill those. The economy has driven or has slowed the growth in Charlotte.
So when you say mothballs, you're not hauling them off to a storage yard. You're leaving them in place and just locking the doors. What are you doing?
That's correct. It costs to relocate a mobile and actually get it set up for use is about $20,000. It doesn't cost quite that much to relocate one and just sit it down. But it would be several million dollars for us to marshal them to a central location, and then it would cost $25,000 a piece to put them back in the service. So we're going to leave them where they are.
And are there concerns about leaving them where they are in terms of deterioration, just wear and tear as the sun beats down and the rain falls and the snow and ice build up and things like that?
I do have that concern. This is a new asset management issue for us. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about it at length. One of the first things we've got to do is figure out how quickly will we reoccupy those. Right. And that's hard to determine because that's going to depend upon how fast the economy recovers and how quickly we start to repopulate the county.
So 3 years ago, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the most crowded, how crowded were the schools?
8.
And today, this morning?
4.
Wow. How do you explain that? What happened to all those kids?
They haven't left the district. We've, as I said earlier, we've added a lot of classrooms. We've also have mobile classrooms, which are adequate for learning. And if I've been in this business 17 years, and I've yet to have a kid tell me they didn't enjoy being in a mobile classroom.
So does this ameliorate in any way the rising student-teacher ratio?
That has been part of it. Obviously, we've ushered out several hundred teachers over the last 2 years, so the student-teacher ratio has gone up. That has helped abate that.
Mm-hmm. Let's get back to this 2007 bond issue, because the voters did vote to give you money to build schools and to make repairs on schools, and you haven't issued all of the bonds yet. And part of that, I understand, is because you don't want to hurt the debt rating of the system or the county?
Well,
is that right?
Actually, the county issues the debt, and I think their concern is that they've got a tremendous amount of debt still outstanding. They are concerned about the bond rating. They want to reevaluate how they manage it. They're looking at pay-as-you-go as an option. They're looking at setting up an account that would accrue over the years to be used for capital expenditures. So at this time, I don't expect to see any amount of bonds issued within the next year, at least for CMS.
All of which makes sense from a fiscal standpoint, if you want to be fiscally conservative and smart, particularly in this economy, on the one hand. On the other hand, it would seem, and maybe I'm wrong about this, that construction costs right now would be much lower than they would have been 3 years ago or maybe 2 years from now, and material costs may be lower now than they will be.
Yeah, there's no question. Construction costs are as low as they have been in 10 years.
So are we being penny wise and pound foolish?
I can't answer that. You need to talk to the finance folks. I would like to take the opportunity now to get a lot of projects under bid. We would, I think we would save a lot of money. And my concern is that once the economy does recover, we're going to be left with a construction industry that is going to be decimated by companies going out of business. And so as soon as capital funds are available, the price is going to go up.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you have a more square footage and slightly less, not enough staff to maintain these buildings. Is there enough money to maintain these buildings under the current scenario?
We do the best we can. We, in our budget, we have about $1 a square foot, which is $20 million for general preventive maintenance. Typically, a well-run organization would allocate $2 a square foot. Mm-hmm. So that's I think, a $20 million shortfall annually to do preventive maintenance. So typically, we don't do preventive maintenance except on major capital equipment like chillers and other mechanical equipment. A lot of maintenance activities are to check things out and adjust and oil and grease and tighten. We don't do that. If something breaks, we will go fix it.
On this first day of school, Guy Chamberlain is our guest in this first part of the program, Associate Superintendent at CMS for Auxiliary Services. It was announced that North Carolina is getting $400 million in federal Race to the Top funds. How much of that will go to CMS, or do we know?
I don't think we know the allocation. Typically, CMS represents about 10% of what the state distributes.
So was this a surprise to you yesterday when this was announced that the state was going to get this money? Did the school system have advance warning of it, or did they?
Well, quite frankly, that's not an area that I worry too much about, but I knew that we were in contention.
Okay. In addition to that, that is in addition to the $25.7 million in federal education jobs money that CMS has already received.
That
correct?
Is correct.
Now, Dr. Gorman wants to save that money. It's $25.7 million. That he wants to save next year instead of hiring or rehiring teachers for this year. Is that a final decision?
I don't think it's final. I think that's what his recommendation to the board is.
And his thinking behind that is what? Because that kind of, to me, defeats the purpose of the money. It's stimulus money, and if we don't use it, we're not stimulating anything.
Well, the problem is there is a funding cliff next year, and we will probably have to eliminate a large number of staff because we have retiring ARRA funding that will no longer exist. So we're going to have to, if we don't save that money till next year to continue those positions for at least another year, we're going to go through another RIF, and then at the end of the next year, we'll go through yet another RIF. So I think he's trying to forestall that.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's also a concern that by the time we get the funds and go through the recruiting process, we won't have employees in the district until late fall.
And the Race to the Top money that was announced yesterday, and we don't know how much CMS would be getting from this because it's going to the state. How is that money supposed to be used? Is it for in the classroom? Is it for infrastructure? What's it for?
It's primarily classroom.
So instruction, teacher salaries?
Yes, sir.
Materials?
That's correct.
Okay. As we mentioned, you're also responsible for transportation, and this year you're running shuttles to certain magnet schools from other schools. When was that decision arrived at, and how much money do you think it will save?
It was arrived at during the budget process. We scrambled to find a variety of ways to reduce operational costs, and one of the ideas was our shuttle transportation costs are higher per capita than regular transportation, and we wanted to find a way to reduce that cost.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought by bringing students or having students come to a midpoint from their home and then shuttling them in from that point, it would reduce the mileage. And thus far, we believe we can park close to 100 buses as a result of that.
But how many people can get on the bus and go to those shuttle stops versus having people drive them to the shuttle stops?
Good question. In most cases, they will probably have to be driven. We have worked with CATS, and CATS has a mechanism by which a parent could find out where the nearest stop is.
I have to take a break. I have a follow-up to that as well. Guy Chamberlain is our guest. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment, and then we'll hear about freshman year in college and how important it is to a student's life. Stay with the Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is made possible in part today by Mary Poppins, Broadway's hit musical from Disney and Cameron McIntosh. Performances through September 19th in the Belk Theater. Tickets are available at 704-372-1000. Kathy Reichs is a best-selling novelist many times over. I think she has 14 books to her credit now, many of them New York Times bestsellers. Her Tempe Brennan books are the basis for the TV series on Fox called Bones, which she also produces and has contributed a few screenplays to as well. A forensic anthropologist by trade, she's one of only 83 certified anthropologists, forensic anthropologists, certified by the American Board of Forensic Anthropology, and now she's adding a new distinction to her resume. She is a matriarch of a family of writers. She'll be with us, Kathy Reichs will, along with her daughter Carrie and son Brendan, to talk about their work tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Reim Show, morning after analysis of primary results in five states, including Alaska, Arizona, and Florida. With less than 70 days till the midterm elections, how the races are shaping up and why it matters.
That's the Diane Reim Show this morning from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 FM WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Guy Chamberlain is our guest. He's the Associate Superintendent for Auxiliary Services at the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools on this first day of school, on this first day of the magnet school shuttle system, which went into effect. And we just talked about how, in many cases, parents will have to drive their children to a shuttle stop, which are specified schools, and then get on a bus that will take them to their magnet school. How many instances would it be easier for the parent just to drive them to the magnet school?
I can't count that, but we do have some kids that go 15 to 20 miles from their home to their magnet school. So I think at least this is a compromise that we feel is reasonable.
I know that you're sitting here and not out in the field. You're sitting here talking to us, but I know that you were out earlier this morning. How healthy does that system seem? Does it seem to be working pretty well?
It seems to be working real well. We have every single shuttle stop staffed with our transportation operational specialists. Mm-hmm. The number of students actually being picked up is low. We're probably less than 40% at least at this point. But that's not unexpected for the first day of school. My expectation is within the next week we will have an idea of what the true number is. A lot of parents choose to drive their kids to school on the first day.
How big an impact to what you oversee will the school board's decision to guarantee students the opportunity to attend a home school have? Will it affect student populations particularly?
No, and I think for the most part, the student assignment plan that's in effect today generally guarantees a student placement in a home near or a school near their home. It may not be the closest, but for the most part, the home schools that we have are not that far away from a student lives.
And this may be a Dr. Gorman question and not a Guy Chamberlain question, but what impact will that decision have on the system's goal to maximize student achievement?
I'll defer that to Dr. Gorman.
Darn the luck. In light of ongoing budget restraints, you're also considering, and this is going to be controversial in the coming year, it seems to me, consolidating and closing some schools. Where does that stand at the moment?
No place. There's going to have to be substantial discussions. It's my expectation that as we get into the budget process starting after the first of the year, mm-hmm. that those discussions will start.
Because for your what you oversee, you need to know something fairly soon, don't you?
Well, certainly any decisions about consolidation need to be made before December because that's when the lottery starts for student assignment. So I imagine those discussions are going to happen within the next month or so.
What will be the process? How will you decide? How will the system decide what school gets consolidated with what other school and what some schools may be closed? How do you decide?
I think generally what will happen is that staff will come up with a series of proposals with what the cost implication is, and arguably in a number of cases, from a cost standpoint, we can reduce our operational cost. Mm-hmm. If we shut a school building down, we say $4 a square foot.
If you're concerned about mothballing trailers, how concerned are you about shutting a school down and what happens to the physical? Because you may need that school again.
Well, we would have to maintain it. It would be in a mothballed status. We would cycle the mechanical system periodically to make sure that it doesn't get excess humidity.
Mm-hmm.
We have property managers who would routinely inspect it on a periodic basis. But I really don't know where we're going with that.
Will you be looking at just cost, or will you be looking at performance of a certain school?
From my perspective, it's going to be what is the cost implication. From the education side, certainly there may be impacts on right. on the education.
Would they be more likely to be consolidating a low-performance school with a high-performance school as opposed to a low-performance with a low-performance, or shutting down a low-performance school as opposed to a high-performance school?
Good question.
You don't know?
I don't know.
Okay. You're also responsible for nutrition.
Yes, sir.
You have an odd job. You have a lot of different responsibilities. What impact, if any, do these budget cuts that you're facing right now have on the school lunch program and the school breakfast program for a lot of kids?
None whatsoever. Child nutrition is an enterprise fund. We get reimbursed by the federal government for free and reduced lunch, and then the students pay. Students that are not FRL pay for their own meals. And I think it's important to note that we have not raised our lunch prices in 10 years.
What are they, by the way? They were 35 cents when I was in school. That's a long time ago.
It was, but it's $2 today.
Wow, inflation. The school board has just recently broached the topic of year-round education. They're going to be looking at this over the next couple of months. Would this be helpful to you in terms of crowding? Because I would think that kids would go on not everybody would go at once, right? They'd go on a staggered schedule.
Typically, you would have children on four tracks, only three of which would be in the schoolhouse at any given time. So you can increase the capacity of the district by 25%. At this point, I don't see that is really an imperative thing for us to do. We have.
You mean year-round education?
Not right now. We have 600 classrooms that are vacant today. Arguably, one thing that is impacted is that you're operating the school year-round. We use that summer period to do a lot of high-intensity maintenance items that might get precluded mm-hmm. by having kids in the school 365 days a year.
It would be difficult, it seems to me. It would seem to be putting together pupil assignments every year and figuring out if you have enough teachers and enough classrooms to handle the student population in a certain area, although you get used to it after a while, is a Herculean feat, it seems to me. When will you know that the changes you have made this year, you and Dr. Gorman and others have made this year, are actually working out to your satisfaction and to the satisfaction of parents and students and teachers?
The changes that we have made on the operations side have been primarily budgetary limitations, and so we'll know at the end of the year, did we save what we anticipated saving? From the academic side, that's a question I can't answer.
Okay. Well, good luck on this first day of school. I know that you're off to check out how things are going the moment you leave here today.
Yes,
right?
Sir. That's correct.
Guy Chamberlain is Associate Superintendent of Auxiliary Services for Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools. Well, even as primary and secondary students flood classrooms this fall, a new crop of students is also heading off for their first year of college. The freshman year of college is a time of excitement, adjustment, and exploration, and it can also set the groundwork for the rest of your life. I learned that yesterday. It was surprising to me. That last statement puts the first year of college in a whole different light and emphasizes the importance of leveling out the bumps in the road and avoiding some of the pitfalls that freshman year can bring. And here to talk about that is Brian Ralph, Vice President of Enrollment Management at Queen's University of Charlotte. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning, Mike.
You guys have been in school for... Are you in school yet?
Today is our first day.
Really?
Well, yes, sir.
Wow. All right. How can you be here?
I've got a lot of good people making things happen on campus.
All right. When I was in school, it was my impression that that first year of college, that freshman year, was the time when you got your footing and a time when a lot of freshmen were uncertain about why they were there, aside from the fact that you had to go to college, didn't know what they were going to major in. And that's okay because you had time. Some people didn't settle on a major till some place in junior year or changed a couple of times. They used that year to learn how to deal with newfound freedoms and responsibilities. But there were always times to fix the problems. Have things changed? Is it more critical now to to hit the ground running your freshman year?
I think there's certainly a higher level of expectation that students are positioned to be successful from day one. I think that comes from a number of things that have been in play over the last 10 or 15 years. Certainly, we've read a lot and learned a lot about the millennial generation, and so they've come up in an environment where they've had a lot more opportunities to engage in a lot of different things and not have had to experience as many failures as perhaps you or I did when we went to school.
Meaning everybody got a trophy?
They did, and we don't hand out trophies at freshman orientation. And I say that jokingly, but there are a lot of great things that the millennials bring as well. And one of the things that I think a lot of colleges and universities are working with is trying to figure out how to best adapt that first year to some of the millennial traits that come through. At the same time, to your point earlier, preparing them to be ready for life. And that's a difficult balancing act. There's a great article in the New York Times yesterday about how orientation programs are working very strategically to bring students in, but then also allow those parents to be part of that experience, but then also move on. And it's, I think the role of the parents in the first year has also changed dramatically.
Yeah, we've done a couple of shows on this in the past where parents seem to cling to Susie and Johnny's college career, where they'll get on the phone with a counselor or a teacher and say, how dare you give my son or my daughter a C? Mm-hmm. What's up with that? That would never have happened when I was in school. Is it going to be happening with millennials as well?
I think there certainly are some things that we're seeing that are trending that way. I think that colleges are really trying to partner with parents and help them understand the changes that we're trying to institute in that first year, in particular developing a higher level of autonomy, helping students really identify their own gifts and talents and skills so that they can flourish independent of mom and dad, but still keep that relationship intact.
What are some of the traits of this generation entering college today for the first time?
Well, oftentimes millennials kind of get pigeonholed with some of the more challenging traits, that being, we joked earlier about getting trophies and a lot of recognition early on and expecting that. But some of the great traits that we see is they're fantastic at working in groups. They have a very high orientation towards service and giving to others. They also really have a very strong orientation towards performance and doing the best that they can.
And all of those things play to the strength of Queen's University, interestingly.
They absolutely do, and that's one of the things we really try to position our students as they're coming in to work through that early on. In fact, during their freshman orientation this year, they all took an instrument that helped identify what some of those skills and traits were, along with some of the challenges they might experience, and then we matched them up with a staff member to help walk through some of those.
Through all time, every incoming freshman has had expectations of what college life is going to be like, some positive, some negative, some eager, some worrisome. What role do those expectations that you naturally bring with you play in your freshman year?
It's interesting. Some of the research that's out there and some of the research that I've done, a lot of those expectations get suppressed a little bit because of the natural ambiguity that is involved in becoming a college freshman. And we often tell the parents of the incoming freshmen, don't forget, these are high school seniors 3 months removed. They haven't learned how to be a college freshman yet. That's part of the learning process. So some of those expectations get kind of put on a pause button for a minute until the student kind of figures out what life is really going to be like. I think that one of the big expectations that evolved now that certainly is different from when you and I went to school is the expectation of immediate employment upon graduation, having numerous opportunities. Part of that's the economic issue. But we've also seen, if you look at a lot of the research that comes out of the Higher Education Research Institute, when students went to college in the 60s and 70s and early 80s, their expectation was to use the collegiate experience to develop as an individual, develop a meaningful philosophy of life, and really had secondarily, I know a career is going to come and I'm excited about that when it does. That's really changed dramatically.
But does a student's expectation of what college should be, could be, will be, affect how they perform in college?
I think to a degree. One of the interesting traits we have struggle with, and this is across the country, is only about two-thirds of all college students actually attend their first-choice institution. So another third of students are at schools that they really was their second or third or in some cases fourth choice. So those expectations of what they thought their first-choice institution was going to be spread to a second choice or third choice institution,
so
there's a lot of disconnect.
So are they bummed out? Are they?
Certainly that can be the case. And that can be everything from, especially this generation, many of them have their own room growing up, and right. so all of a sudden having to share a room with a roommate, some of those challenges that come about. I think also the sense that the expectations that everybody's going to be watching out for me. Mm-hmm. And while some colleges do that better than others, there's always a level of autonomy that we want to develop right. in a student's life, and some of those struggles are difficult.
Yeah, it's a difficult transition for a lot of young people, as you would imagine. What are some of the more common challenges or even pitfalls that freshmen tend to have to come into contact with and live or die by?
Sure. I think one of the biggest ones we see is students moving from a fairly structured life, everything from when they have to be at school, when they don't have to be at school, when their activities start after school, and when they move into the collegiate environment, certainly there are class times which students have to be in. But on average, students are in class 15 to 18 hours a week, which leaves them roughly 150 hours that before was pretty scheduled, whether it was after school activities or doing things with a family. And so time management is definitely one of the things that we see students struggle with.
I don't know how it is with these latest generations. Mm-hmm. I know that my parents paid close attention to us. They didn't overschedule us like today's parents tend to do. But they looked at our report cards, and they made sure that we did our homework and in high school. Not overtly, but it was like, you did get your homework done before you go out and do your thing, right? Okay, fine. Go. See you later. That goes away when you go to college.
No question.
Is that still a problem, or have parents been more lax in supervising their high school students than they used to be?
Well, I think one of the positive traits of the millennials is because they have been hyper-scheduled, mm-hmm. they have been very disciplined when they have the time to do the work.
Okay.
And so there are some positives to that. We see that those traits carry into college. We see a lot of freshmen get very involved very early in their experience, which can work well if they develop those study disciplines. The challenge, of course, there is when the students start making choices that they didn't have the ability to make before, mm-hmm. Participating in different activities or choosing not to participate in different activities, those types of things.
Kids who get into college are fairly smart.
Absolutely.
Kids who get into Queen's University and Davidson and places like that are very smart.
Absolutely.
Do they have less of a difficult time making the transition than perhaps students at the public universities might?
That's a good question. There are certainly correlations between aptitude and academic performance and overall success at the college level. But the fact of the matter is that the freshman experience, while certainly an academic experience, is also a social, personal experience. And every student goes through different, you know, dynamics in which they're going to struggle, whether it's emotional, motivational, attitudinal, a lot of those different variables that are at play. So all of them are going to struggle to a degree, but academic, especially students are being over-challenged academically, mm-hmm. can cause a much earlier struggle.
What's the biggest help of helping kids who are having a trouble making this transition adapt? Is it peer pressure from upperclassmen who say, you know, you'll get through this hump, or maybe just change roommates, or just advice from upperclassmen?
Mm-hmm.
Is it advice from peers, fellow freshmen? Is it advice from faculty and staff, counselors, parents? Who helps them the most?
Sure. I can certainly say at Queen's University of Charlotte, our faculty are heavily engaged in helping those students through that transition. We have a program, it's a first-year class that is team-taught by faculty, and they really get to know their students.
Mm-hmm.
In general, on most college campuses, I think it comes from a couple different forms. One, certainly peers and observing peers and those types of behaviors. Many institutions have very good services in place, whether they're academic support services, helping students with something as simple as, hey, I just really love somebody to read this paper, to I really need tutoring for Chemistry 101.
Right.
And so I think those things are in play as well. And then, frankly, the resident assistants, who are current students who live in the residence halls or in leadership positions, they play a critical role in helping students find their way.
Brian Ralph is Vice President for Enrollment Management at Queen's University of Charlotte. We're talking about freshman year in college for students not just at Queen's but everywhere, and some of the pitfalls and how to overcome them and how to acclimate to college life successfully. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. And Charlotte Talks is made possible in part today by Hendrick Acura in Charlotte, featuring the redesigned 2010 MDX and the new ZDX with a 3.7-liter six-cylinder engine and an array of financing options. Virtual tours at HendrickAcura.com. Morning after analysis of primary results in five states coming up at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. Alaska, Arizona, and Florida among those five states. And with less than 70 days till the midterms, how the races are shaping up and why it matters. That's Diane Rehm at 10 o'clock this morning. If you'd like to join our conversation, do so. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323. 800-603-WFAE. Or every other way imaginable, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Going to a brand new high school has perks. New classroom supplies, new athletic equipment, and more opportunity to make the varsity team. Then there's the downside.
I'm actually really scared that no one's going to want to go to the games. Oh, this is lame.
Building school spirit from scratch. Thursday on Morning Edition as WFAE continues its look inside CMS schools.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Brian Ralph, Vice President of Enrollment Management at Queen's University of Charlotte. We're talking about that critical freshman year of college when students have some experiences that make or break their college careers and have experiences that can set them up for the rest of their lives, which actually surprised me when I read this yesterday, but it makes a lot of sense for many reasons, which we'll talk about in this next segment. You were just telling me off the air that this transitional period, the most critical period of the transitional period from high school to college, is the first 6 weeks of college life. And yet, as many as one-third of college students leave college without graduating, and most of them do so in that first year of college. Do we know which factors play the largest role in that number, in that figure?
Mm-hmm. Certainly, a number of factors are usually cited, everything from some of the social and psychological issues such as making friends, homesickness, those types of things. Financial strain, especially over these last couple of years, has been certainly something that has weighed on a lot of students' minds, even if they're not personally struggling, knowing that mom and dad might be struggling at home mm-hmm. to make ends meet. Those are certainly things that play into it. Oftentimes, what the research shows, though, is that there's a number of variables that start working together, kind of a piling-on effect. Maybe a couple struggles academically. One of the big differences from collegiate work and high school work is that most students get feedback very, very regularly on their academic performance in high school. When you move to the college level, you might not have your first exam for your first 4 or 5 weeks, and if that doesn't go too well, students can often struggle with that. And so those are some of the variables that play. And then certainly just the huge transition of moving from, in many cases, their own room to a very community-style residential environment has some challenges associated with it.
Having to budget time, having to budget money, having to make new friends, having to form relationships, you know, navigate a whole new system of everything.
Exactly.
Are there secrets to success in this, to make this transition easier in those first 6 weeks?
There is, actually. And one of the really neat bodies of research that's evolved over the last 10 years has been coming out of the University of Indiana, focusing on student engagement. And what they've discovered is that students that find different levels of engagement with the college or university have much higher success rates than students that don't. And engagement comes in a lot of different forms. It can come with engagement with faculty, such as, are the classrooms designed in such a way to foster faculty-student interaction? Mm-hmm. Do they have engaging experiences? For example, do they get a chance to do an internship or travel internationally or do research with a faculty member? They also looked at things such as a supportive campus environment. Is the culture of the campus embracing and raising the level of expectation of success of students?
Are these things that people should look for before they choose a college?
Absolutely.
How do you figure that out in a site visit for a junior in high school or a senior in high school?
Sure. There are several hundred colleges that use the survey. It's called the NESE survey, National Survey for Student Engagement. Several hundred schools use those. These are surveys that literally reflect the thoughts of the freshman and the senior at that particular institution.
Huh.
Most of that information is available publicly. They've actually partnered with USA Today to publish those results on the USA Today website. So you can go and at least get a feeling for what types of engagement opportunities exist at a particular institution.
Back in prehistory, when I went to college, you went off to school, you got your dorm room assigned, your parents left you at the doorstep, and you waved goodbye and had moments of anxiety on both sides of the equation.
Absolutely.
And then you went off and you did your college thing. And if you were lucky, you could phone home once a week in the dorm phone, which you could not hear because everybody was in the hallway doing weird things. And you were lucky to get the phone when you could get it. Now we have cell phones, Facebook, Skype. And I've been told by parents that they are more in touch with their kids when they go to college than they were when they were in high school because they call them literally 3 or 4 times a day. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think that from a transitional standpoint, that it is helpful, I think, for some students to have that transitional moment with the parent unit. I think one of the benefits that comes from that is it allows for a slow adaptation of the relationship between the student and the mom and dad, who, as you've already noted, have a very, very tight relationship. This generation in particular is very connected both electronically as well as activity-wise. And so there is, I think there's some healthiness to that. I think one of the challenges with it is that what we've seen, and I think what the research shows, is that some of the students, when they face adversity, oftentimes have not had to solve those problems on their own. And so some of the challenges that evolve is the inability to kind of tackle some of those tougher issues, instead maybe going to mom or dad too quickly instead of developing those skills.
So what should the parents do? What should their response be?
Well, I think one of the things that we tell our parents when we're working with them is certainly we want them engaged in the experience, but we want them to really challenge their student to use the resources that are available on campus, that mom or dad shouldn't be calling the president's office the first time that the student locks themselves out of their residence hall room. And we say that jokingly, but the point is that we really want those students to develop those skills, that we absolutely believe that the college experience should be transformational, and that should be part of that experience.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's part of going to college.
Absolutely.
It's not just the book learning, it's life learning.
Absolutely.
Which begins there. We talked a little bit about connections being made by students, among students and among faculty members. And you've done some research on this.
Mm-hmm.
What kinds of connections are these? How do they work? How long do they last? Some of them, I would think, are lifelong connections. I have a few.
Absolutely. I think there are a couple different folds. Certainly the social relationships that evolve, especially in the freshman year, oftentimes with a freshman roommate or people on the wing, those, as you've pointed out, oftentimes develop into lifelong relationships. It's the shared experience. It's the community experience of living in that environment that really allows those things to develop. And frankly, that's when, for the first time, these students are interacting with students from very different backgrounds and places and starting to find that there is a shared experience that they can really build on. The faculty relationships, interestingly, and I think it largely depends on the type of institution, certainly at a smaller institution like Queens or Davidson, those relationships also certainly have the potential to last a very long time because of the intimacy that evolves in research or having two classes with a particular faculty member or them being your advisor throughout your major.
And you also become, in high school, the teacher is God.
Mm-hmm.
We hope. And in college, suddenly you become, as you go through the system, you become an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore you begin to form these adult relationships with your teacher. They're still your teacher. They still know more than you do, but they're treating you differently, and you're treating them differently. It seems to me that's part of the experience as well. But does that come in the freshman year, or does it come much later?
I think that it evolves over time. Certainly they get exposed to it in the freshman year. I think that the students aren't quite as comfortable starting to engage at that level. The faculty certainly try to create that opportunity with some structures, you've noted.
So how should students approach making these connections with peers, with upper class people, with faculty and staff? Is this something that just comes naturally to most of these people? And you mentioned the social nature of the millennials and their ability to work together.
Mm-hmm. I think that absolutely will come natural to some extent, but certainly, and we joke about this all the time, we can't read students' minds yet. Colleges are good, but we're not that good. And so if they're struggling or if they want to get engaged in something, but they're not taking the initiative, they're going to struggle because we don't know until they really reach out to somebody. And so colleges and universities are spending a lot of time and energy trying to make resources available, but there's only so much we can do for a student actually to engage in utilizing that resource, whether it's taking on a leadership class or becoming a member of a club or organization or maybe going and getting that extra academic support that they need.
Are there gender differences in how this transition is handled?
There are. There's a couple of things that are at play right now in the U.S. that are pretty interesting. One, women are going to college in general at a much higher rate than men. And what we're seeing is that women graduate at a higher rate. They generally have higher SAT scores overall. So there are some academic transitional things that make that part a little bit easier for females than men. There are some things that institutions are doing, though, to obviously help men be more successful. And part of it is creating an environment where they can build community. And I think the other part of it, especially for larger institutions, as we've seen throughout the last 15 years in particular, is a real strong emphasis on athletics.
But, I mean, yeah, do men have an easier time of this than women, or is it the other way around? Because women seem to have better they talk about things more than men do. Men talk about sports.
Mm-hmm. In general, what we see is that the women definitely have a more successful transition than men. That That's largely reflected both in the number of students who leave after the first year, which tends to be a little slightly higher men than women. But that doesn't mean that guys can't obviously be successful, and institutions work differently to help those students along.
Is this a time of life where young people discover who they are as a person? I mean, are certain identifying characteristics either developed or discovered that carry them they carry with them through life?
No question. One of the great parts of the collegiate experience is that students are moving from the capture of knowledge to the ability to think and to reason. A lot of the high school experience, while certainly there's a lot of challenging curriculum there, it's a lot of acquisition of knowledge, and certainly that takes place at the collegiate level. But the real challenge comes when students learn to think. And as they start learning to think and learning how to learn, they start developing a much healthier level of thought around, well, who am I? What are the big questions in life that I need to address? And that is really when a pretty neat journey takes place.
And I guess this is also when some parents become concerned because they worry that the student will adopt thoughts and opinions that are different than what they have been raised with. How dangerous is that? How should we view that?
Sure.
How should the student view that? Because it could be very uncomfortable for them to challenge their own beliefs.
No question. And I think that first thing I would say to parents is that you've invested 18 years. If it's going to get undermined in the first 6 weeks, then there's probably some other things at play there. I think the challenge is, at the end of the day, they're going to be a stronger thinker. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that some of the things that they've learned and grown up with aren't going to be challenged. And on both sides of the equation, I think oftentimes it's always assumed that it's going to be a more liberal perspective, but I think that you certainly can also have more conservative perspectives as well.
Are these lifelong identity shifts or identity characteristics, or are these subject to change over time, just like everything else? Because we are told that we need to reinvent ourselves every couple of years in this society in which we live.
Absolutely. Our argument would be is that if a student really has had an exceptional undergraduate experience and really developed critical thinking skills and learning how to learn, that is the start of the process, but there will be no end. Mm-hmm. So those 4 years, while formative, are certainly just the foundation on which those critical questions are going to be asked for the rest of somebody's life.
How difficult is that? Because I get the impression, talking to people about secondary education, that it's a lot of it's not based on critical thinking. A lot of it is based on rote.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly there is no necessarily right or wrong, yes or no. You have to get at the answer through reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
How difficult is that for a lot of people?
It's extremely difficult. And I can tell you that in particular, we have a core class that is offered the first year of the freshman year. And that oftentimes is the first time that students have been exposed to open-ended questions without necessarily a black and white answer. Yeah. And for some students, that is a huge shift in the type of learning that they've experienced, but more importantly, how they've even thought about themselves or the world around them. We tend to think that's a good thing because at the end of the day, regardless of what their overall perspectives are, they've developed some really great critical thinking skills and analytical skills that are going to serve them for the rest of their lives.
And we know now that the adult brain is not fully formed, at least in the male, till about 27 or 28. Does that play a role in all this too? I mean, you're still a kid at heart.
Absolutely.
And upstairs, too.
No question. And I think that certainly as the students move throughout their 4 years or 5 years, depending on the type of institution, that growth certainly accelerates during those last couple years because of the level of critical thinking that develops, and also to the point that you made earlier, Mike, the level of relationship that they have with the faculty, the higher level of challenge, the higher level of engagement that comes as you develop as an individual.
When should parents and students begin preparing for this first year? Maybe too late for some freshmen who are in there right now today, mm-hmm. if they haven't thought about this. But what can parents and students do to get ready for this new experience?
Sure.
And when should it start?
Well, certainly there's been a lot of discussion about when students should apply to college and things like that, and I think that largely depends on the type of institution they're looking at. But certainly the junior year of high school is a good time to start the discussion around the type of institution that the student should be thinking about, what types of characteristics they're looking for in an institution. But I think in particular, oftentimes parents will push off the discussion about the transition until well into the summer before they're going into their freshman year, which I think is way too late. And I think oftentimes it's either denial that the separation is going to take place, or it's the idea that they want to get everything they can out of those last couple months of the senior year. I think that's a flaw because the discussion really needs to start taking place during that senior year, both so that the student is socially and academically prepared for that first year, but also, frankly, so that relationship has started to adapt and change, being aware of the dynamics of how different the dynamics are going
to be. But can you really prepare somebody for a hypothetical situation that they have no experience with until they have the experience?
Certainly, no, in some ways you can't. But I think there are a lot of things that families and students can do. For one, certainly talk with current students at other colleges, either friends that graduated before, and get connected with current students to really help understand that first year. We also, at least at Queens, we have parent panels where we bring panels of current students, bring those parents in front of prospective student parents and encourage them to ask them any right. question that they want. And I would encourage them, they probably have people in their neighborhood that have sent freshmen off earlier. Really understanding what some of those challenges are is really important.
What are some of the warning signs that faculty look for in a student who may be having difficulty, or that friends can look for, or that you can notice in yourself that things, that you need help, that things aren't going well?
That's a great question, a really important one. First and foremost, faculty look for academic disengagement, and that can come in a number of forms. Not attending class regularly, maybe turning in assignments late, not contributing to class discussions. Those would be some of the variables that they're going to look at. From a parent standpoint, I think the parents are going to know the child better than anybody, so they're going to start listening for cues. If they start hearing comments that seem not like their child, oftentimes that can come in the form of not feeling particularly social, or not making a lot of friends, or I'm kind of bored. Mm-hmm. If you're bored in the first 6 weeks of your freshman year,
Something's wrong. So what can you do? Because sometimes these parents are long distance.
Absolutely. Well, that's oftentimes when student life staff can really play an important role. First and foremost, those students in particular, if they start identifying those characteristics, they really should talk with a resident advisor. Those students have been trained to help students acclimate, get them plugged into where they need to get plugged into, including, if necessary, you know, maybe visiting with a school counselor just to talk through some of those issues.
Is that an instance when a parent hears a disengagement on the phone for them to become engaged with somebody at the university?
I think our preference would be, first and foremost, encourage the student to take responsibility and say, hey, you know what, it sounds like you're struggling a little bit. Why don't you go see your academic advisor, or maybe go over to the counseling center? If that doesn't seem to be working, we certainly on occasion have taken calls from parents expressing some significant concern and intervened when necessary.
Brian Ralph is Vice President of Enrollment Management at Queens University of Charlotte on this first day of class. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.